100 days on the place, yeah, man. It's a kick it, you know. That's right.
Yeah, me rolling and rock it to the beat, and me love the sound.
Oh, Chess, you can mess with the sound. Better grab your girl, your posse, and gather round.
Yeah, me rolling and bobbing and going like a mad man. Oh, the man got the sweet day off and 19 no long, so me say.
Hey, Digital Sister is back. I want to say hello to my new friends in Santiago, Chile, who have been downloading the podcast. Welcome, and thank you for tuning in. And thanks to all of my listeners who continue to tune in and pass the podcast around, and to my new friends who have been added to my friends list on the podcast. I really appreciate it, and thank you for tuning in, and we're just having a great time as the podcast grows. Well, let me get right into our little reflections on this podcast. We just got past September 11th, and again, this is the fifth anniversary, and it's always, I think, just so tragic in many ways to see what happened and what unfolded. But I'd like to share with you that I, in fact, at one point worked in the World Trade Center. I worked on the 59th floor for Dean Witter, which was there a couple years ago. And I have to tell you, if you have never been inside of the World Trade Center before it went away, it was like a city in itself. It was huge. The number one local train, the last stop was the World Trade Center. PATH trains came in there from New Jersey. Every kind of nationality you can imagine walking through the concourse there of the World Trade Center, you saw. There were stores there, medical offices, all kinds of things there, restaurants, you name it, it was there. It really was a city unto itself within that gigantic block area. But as I was saying, when I went to work at Dean Witter, we had to get in the first elevator bank, and that took us up to, I can't remember which floor, but I'll just say, you know, 25 or something, or 30 something. And then you would get off and have to walk across the elevator bank to take a next set of elevators, which took you up to the 59th floor. Now, that was high enough, okay, and frightening enough to have to go to work like that every day. Because one time the elevator dropped and scared us all to death, long before the terrorist situations went on. But I can't imagine having to, let's say, get off at the elevator bank that took you up to the floors on the 50th floor, and having to get off of that bank, walk across, and take yet another set of elevators that would take you up perhaps another 30 or 40 stories, and then take another elevator that would get you up to the top of the World Trade, which I believe was 104 floors, something like that. So it was just mind-boggling to be in that building, because it was, like I said, just a city unto itself. But as I said before, you walked around, you saw every kind of nationality you can imagine. Now that gets me to looking at some of the memories and the reflections of the fifth anniversary of 9/11 on some of the news shows. And I have to say my hat is off to Soledad O'Brien on CNN, because she interviewed an African-American woman who survived getting out of the World Trade Center. And she worked on the 89th floor. And she described what happened and how, you know, the plane came in and people were just horrified and covered in black and dust and everything, and just, and really traumatized, and how they immediately went to the stairwell. And she said people weren't panicked, but they knew they had to get out of there. And they were talking, and then the second plane hit, and then that's when the building shook, the staircase shook and all that. And then, you know, the panic, of course, set in. And she said at one point, because people were starting to go back up and some people were starting to go back down, that she was the only person left in that stairwell. And she said she didn't know what to do, but I believe she said there was a fireman or someone who managed to get to them and said, no, come this way. And so she was able to survive, and she was so grateful, and she thanked, you know, her angel who really saved her life, which is one of the firefighters. But in any event, I was just delighted that Soledad interviewed this African-American woman who survived. I unfortunately can't remember her name. Because, you see, when you looked at all of the news shows and shows that were providing reflections about 9/11, you know, I hate to break this down, but it's an observation. I really only saw that only this tragedy seemed to affect only white people. And I think that's just so unfortunate that even with a tragedy of this magnitude in New York City, the melting pot of the world, that our news media is still painting the tragedy as if this only occurred to white people. And I think that's just totally wrong. I mean, I watched Larry King, and, you know, he's not one of my favorite interviewers, because my favorite interviewer is Jack Parr, the late, great Jack Parr, because that's who I like to pattern my style after. But I watched Larry King, and he did not have one person of color on his program talking about being survivors. He had the group of the four wives who lost their husbands, who, you know, are now writing a book, and they're talking about, you know, how the situation was, how their friendship grew, and this book was put together, you know, to show a sense of hope. And he had the firefighters on, the one particular firehouse that tragically lost about 15 of their members, and they said for the firehouses that were in the lower Manhattan area, some over 300 firefighters were killed. And again, as I looked at the pictures of the firefighters, you know, it was all Caucasian. I mean, every now and then, I think there was one Latino. And I, you know, it's no disrespect for our firefighters, because they're so important, and maybe that reflects, you know, the firefighters that were in that particular house. But I just think the media has to do a better job at showing all of the types of people that were affected by this. And here is something that I learned, which was kind of mind-boggling, with the film that Oliver Stone just created and was released, called World Trade Center. And there was a gentleman there. He was a Marine, an African-American, and he, you know, of course, like everyone else, saw what was going on and went down there to, he put on his Marine uniform and went down there to do what he could to help and rescue people. And he rescued, I believe, two police officers who were Caucasian, and those were the main two, but he, you know, did some other things. But as it turns out, in the film World Trade Center, and the gentleman's name is Jason Thomas, he was watching the previews of World Trade Center and seeing the actor who was really portraying him, and the actor was white. And so we have to wonder, with Oliver Stone, what is it in this country that the heroes always have to be portrayed as white? And apparently Oliver Stone wrote a letter to Jason Thomas apologizing, you know, for not getting the story right. But we all know that when writers, and he's a writer too, Oliver Stone, when they write these films, he does take liberty with things, but they do their homework, they research it, and if he knew to put that story in, he knew that the person who saved those police officers was an African-American man named Jason Thomas. However, he decided and made that decision to whitewash that situation and in the film portray Jason Thomas as a white man. So, you know, I just have to wonder about what is it in our deeply rooted racist culture that some people cannot even give credit where credit is due, and that we want to continue, not we, but they want to continue to perpetuate Caucasian as the white hero. And I guess that's really upset me because of how that happened. But as I looked and I flipped around to a lot of the shows, I mean, this is what I saw. And, you know, it kind of disturbed me because, as I said, if you ever had the opportunity to go into the concourse of the World Trade Center, you saw a little bit of everything, all kinds of people. And what our media is doing is really doing a disservice in perpetuating that this tragedy only happened to white people. And I really, again, say kudos to Soledad O'Brien, because I think with her interview of that woman, that is really the only African-American woman that I saw who was actually interviewed. I maybe saw one other, but two. And I know, out of those thousands of people who perished, I know, and even those, you know, hundreds of people that were able to survive, I know that there were far more women of color, Latina, African American, Native American, whatever. I know that there was more that this situation affected than what the media is portraying. So even in a great tragedy like this that affected so many people and turned up so many lives, the media is still trying to whitewash this tragedy. And I think we have to hold them accountable to at least paint the picture and show the stories of all types of people. It didn't just happen to the white firefighters. It didn't just happen to white people in the World Trade Center. It happened to a lot of people. And remember, kind of freshly after 9/11 happened, remember there was a controversy because they wanted to put up a statue depicting the firefighters who, you know, rescued. And there was a big issue, remember, at that time, because they wanted to show a representation and have one, you know, Caucasian, one Latino, and one African American to show the types of people that this situation affected. And I think ultimately they decided again to show, you know, three white, I think, firefighters or whomever. But again, whitewashing the tragedy. So, you know, we've got to deal with this issue here of not portraying things as they really are, and that the media continues to whitewash situations. And so, you see, that is why we need the Spike Lees. That is why Digital Sister exists, because we have to give a more balanced account of what happens in the media. So, again, 9/11 was just the most horrible thing that could ever happen in this country. So many lives. I mean, I just can't imagine, you know, you're saying goodbye to someone that you normally say goodbye to every morning or whatever, and, you know, that's the last time you see them. Or if they happen to call you on that cell phone, that may have been the last time you ever heard that voice. So, a very tragic situation. Many lives and people are moving forward. But again, let's hold the media accountable and make sure that they portray and interview all types of people, because this tragedy did not just happen to one particular racial group. I also wanted to share a little bit about, because I talked about in the previous podcast about my experience working at the United Nations, because again, I like to educate my listeners, because Americans really are very ignorant for the most part on why the United Nations is needed and some of the things that the United Nations does. As I talked about before, I worked in the area called OPS, which is Office for Project Services, and that was the area that could rebuild a city out of nothing from the New York office. So I worked with a man from India. I worked with a woman from Kenya. I worked with a man from Austria, Mr. Schutzmuller. Khadija Musa was from Kenya, and Mr. Agarwaler was Indian from Bombay. So these are the people that I worked with. And as I mentioned before, we were rebuilding the infrastructure of Pakistan and Afghanistan because the Russians had just left. So that was rebuilding infrastructure. And it's probably, you know, all destroyed again. But in any event, what I want to get across is the United Nations is an organization which is really about peace and really trying to keep the peace. Just to explain the culture of what it was like to be there, every Friday there was a meditation time. And we would go to the main office across the street, and the yoga master, Sri Chinmoy, had meditation, I want to say service, but he had a meditation service every Friday. So all of the United Nations employees who wanted to could go to his meditation service. And we would leave, let's say at 12, let's say 11:30 or 12, and we would be gone for 2-3 hours. So we would come back to the office at, say, anywhere from 2:30 to 3 o'clock. And some, maybe sometimes a little earlier, depending on how the master was feeling. But that shows you the peace culture of the organization, that they would allow their employees time, you know, 3 hours to go and meditate, to go find some peace, and then come back and go back to work. And it didn't impede the workflow. People worked better because they were peaceful. If they needed to stay late, they did. They weren't grumbling. Because why? They were allowed to do something that was important to them. And what was fascinating about this is you would stand in line and you would have a moment in the presence of this great master, Sri Chinmoy, and he would have little gifts for you. He would have little candies for you or something like that, or you could give him a little gift. And it was just so humbling to be in the presence of him, and he would bless you, and it was just wonderful. And then he would sing, or he didn't really talk a lot, but he would, you know, he would play music or something like that. But what was interesting was the people who were his followers and who came there. This was so exciting. At the time, singer Roberta Flack, and her name, because she was a follower of him at the time, I don't know if she still is, but her name was Aditya. And so many Fridays, Roberta Flack would come for the meditation sessions, and she would just come, you know, like she came off the bus from shopping. She'd have her shopping bags, and she had some sunglasses on and a hat on, and she would come and sit and meditate with us. So every week we pretty much had some time to mingle with Roberta Flack. And Michael Narada Walden was also a follower of Sri Chinmoy, and saxophonist Clarence Clemens. So what happened? On some Fridays, Roberta Flack would put on these concerts, and she would fly in her backup singers, and Narada, Michael Walden, and Clarence Clemens would play. So we would hear a free concert put on by Roberta Flack, you know, maybe like once a month or something. It was just wonderful. And you would leave there refreshed, and you would get back to your office and just do what you had to do. But that speaks of the culture of the United Nations. It's about peace. You would never find a corporation in America that would allow its employees, I'm talking about, you know, administrative assistants, people like that, to have a 3-hour meditation time. It would never happen in America. And that's why, you know, people are not wanting to come to work, or they're finding reasons to be sick, and that's why there's a big problem with absenteeism in American corporations, especially people on the middle to lower, you know, management scale. But at the United Nations, that was a different culture. And I can't tell you how refreshing it was to be in that environment. Not only to work with international people, but to work in an environment where peace was the overriding concern. They were concerned with their employees being centered, being content, and having a chance to express something in a sort of non-religious way. And the fact that they let Sri Chinmoy come every Friday, he had the space, he had the location, and people could come and see him. So it was just a really wonderful experience to work at the United Nations, and that's why I'm spending some time talking about it, so that I hope that my message gets out about the United Nations. It is about peace. It is about trying to find solutions in this crazy world with a lot of these crazy leaders who give lip service to being Christians and peace mongers, but who really aren't. And so that's why I continue to share these really life experiences that I've had, because I want you to know that it's very necessary for the United Nations to exist, and that the wealthier nations should really do the right thing and pay into the fee channels that are there to keep the United Nations going, and not withhold just based on political issues. But I just wanted to share that with you so that you truly understand what it was like. And one of the other fascinating things was that every October, that is when the session of the United Nations opens. And so every country has these fabulous parties to, you know, announce that they're here and to, you know, meet their constituents. And so I went to several of the parties. They're called, you know, the mission parties. And you would go, and one in particular I thought was just, it was so elegant, because you had two men dressed in white tie, and they were white gloves, the whole nine yards, and they would ask your name, and you would give them your name, and then the ambassador and his wife would be in the line, and then the gentleman in the white tie would say, "Your Excellency, Madam Ambassador, whomever, I'd like to present, let's say, my name, Celeste Terry. I'd like to present Celeste Terry to you." And so you would go through the line and shake their hands, and it was just, it was wonderful. If you've never had the experience of having yourself announced in such a formal way to an ambassador, to say, "Your Excellency, I am pleased to be here," whatever. It was just a wonderful experience. And I did meet an ambassador one time, because I was at a book club, and I met ambassador. His name was Renagi. He was the ambassador from Papua New Guinea. So he and I became friends, and I hung out with him and took him to, you know, a couple of restaurants so he could see some stuff. I took him over to my uncle's house, and, you know, he couldn't believe it. I said, "You never guess who this is," but, you know, just to be hanging out with an ambassador. And going to his mission party also. So it was a wonderful experience, and one of those once-in-a-lifetime experiences that, you know, most Americans don't have. So that's why I wanted to share that with you. It was wonderful. The UN is necessary, and let's do all we can to keep it doing the work that it needs to do, which is keeping the peace and trying to work through some of the politics of some of the wealthier nations around the globe. Okay, let me move on. Let me give you a little bit of information about some nonprofits, which I think is very interesting. There are three groups that receive the most donations. And when you're predicting who's going to donate, it's best to look at the overall interest of that philanthropic person. So if that person has an interest in the arts, then that's the person you're going to want to go after for soliciting donations for art organizations. It seems that arts donors are some of the most generous, and they average about $215 in donations to arts groups. The second group, which is a big donor base, is education. They kind of give almost an average of $416 to educational organizations. Also another group, an area that's really big, is health-related organizations. Those donations top almost $298 to health-related organizations. So when you're out there soliciting donations from donors, it really makes sense to try and find out what their particular interest is and then kind of target the ask based on that. Speaking about education donors, this is something I just want to give a little information about some nonprofits. There are 4 supporters of the resigned Harvard University President Lawrence Summers who are withholding record-sized donations totaling $390 million from the university until a permanent replacement is named. Now, I did say $390 million from 4 supporters. That is a lot of money. But it also speaks to what I just talked about. Obviously, the 4 supporters are very interested in educational funding. And so, because they have that kind of money, they are withholding it until they basically get what they want, which is, you know, a new president, and to make sure that that new president is aligned with, you know, how they feel. And then if they feel that they're comfortable, they're going to give that $390 million to Harvard. But it's interesting that even though it's still Harvard, there are donors who are withholding based on the political situation at that university. So that's kind of interesting that donors have that power. It looks like Mayor Ray Nagin in New Orleans has set up an agreement with some of the neighborhoods because they got a $3.5 million grant from the Rockefeller Foundation, which is going to help pay for consultants to produce individual recovery plans for some of the neighborhoods. So you see, even though money has been kind of slow from the government and the federal government, you know, the nonprofit industry is still making a way to make grants to organizations that need it. So nonprofit provides a very necessary service to organizations that may not be getting the money that they need to get from the federal government. Let's look at Howard Buffett. He's the son of Warren Buffett, and he was the recipient of $1.1 billion of his father's dispersed fortune. He operates his Howard G. Buffett Foundation, and he's going to operate it until a date in the distant future, at which point he is going to give away the remaining assets and shut down the foundation. So the foundation, by getting that $1.1 billion from his father, will increase to $2.2 billion from $130 million. Now, his foundation supports efforts to increase food production and for clean water in Africa. So that's pretty powerful that he's going to work the foundation and fund his 2 particular areas of interest. And when the money is gone, that's it. That's very interesting that he can do that. But when you have $1.1 billion to play with, you can do anything you want. But again, I think it speaks to the power of nonprofits, the importance of nonprofits, and that's also why I'm weaving that into my commentary, because it's very important that we learn about the good work that nonprofits do. There's also an organization out of Winston-Salem called the Daryl Hunt Project for Freedom and Justice. He was somebody who was formerly incarcerated but was falsely accused. And when he came out, he decided to create a program which really focuses on innocence and forgiveness and helps prisoners who have been wrongly convicted to come out of that situation and to help them become whole. So again, you just never know the breadth and the depth of nonprofits. There are so many out there doing great work, and each week, or at least fairly regularly, I'm going to try and put that kind of information in the podcast so that you can become educated also. So let me shift gears a little bit and just touch a little bit on entertainment. I see that Chris Tucker is gearing up to come back for Rush Hour 3, and he's supposedly going to be getting $25 million. I mean, that is some serious cheddar. But he seems to be more mellow, and so it'll be interesting to see, you know, how things pan out, because he had gotten the big head with Rush Hour 2 with all these demands, and that's why there was a delay, and they were probably almost going to go with someone else. But whatever happened, he seems to have mellowed out, and it seems to be working out okay for him. So we'll look forward to seeing that, because that's a pretty neat franchise, you know, like the Lethal Weapon franchise with Mel Gibson and Danny Glover. But let's talk about Ron Isley. You know, the man is 65 years old, and he was just sentenced to 3 years in prison for tax evasion. You know, it's kind of sad because he just got married again, I think a little over a year ago, and his new wife just had a baby, you know, and here he is, 65 years old, having to go to jail. He's got some health issues because he had a stroke and he had a little bout with kidney cancer. But I'm not trying to be funny, but I'm wondering, is she going to stay for the 3 years? Is she going to visit him in jail and drive up in a Mercedes and a limo? I mean, it's just sad. And, you know, there wasn't any great leniency for him, so he's going to be sent to a Bureau of Prisons hospital facility to serve his time. And the other thing, I think, with him is that he probably got a little arrogant and figured he didn't have to pay. But, you know, you can't make these videos as Mr. Big, you know, wearing bling bling and sipping Cristal and all this kind of stuff. They're videos, but still, he's showing great excess. And, of course, you know, they're looking at that saying, well, you know, obviously he's doing okay. So, you know, there was no sympathy for him. And this is what happened. So, you know, I hope that this prison sentence doesn't hasten any other health issues for him. But, you know, hey, don't play around with the IRS, especially if you're a celebrity making big bucks, because they're going to figure out a way to get you. Remember Willie Nelson and the IRS album that he had to do to pay off his debt. So, you know, I hope everything, I don't know if it gets better, but I just hope that the situation doesn't make his health situation more tenuous, because it can, you know, with the stress. Oh, boy. I think I've probably talked enough to you this time, but I just wanted to share those important reflections with you. Please continue to listen. Please continue to pass the podcast around to your friends and associates. I really appreciate it, and I thank you for listening. So, Digital Sister signing off. I will be back with you in a few days. Take care and have a great week.
Yes, you can mess with the West Side, the West Side.